Under the yellow sky of early morning, and over ground covered with wet snow, Soviet tanks made straight for the thick of the column, plowing up and down, killing and crushing with their tracks. Almost simultaneously, massed Cossack cavalry wheeled away from the tanks to hunt down and massacre men fleeing for the refuge of the hills. Hands held high in surrender, the Cossacks sliced off with their sabers. The killing in this human hunt went on for several hours, and a new round opened on the banks of the river Nilortykych, where the survivors of the first collision of the German column with Soviet troops dragged and fought their way. Welcome to episode 67 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. Remember that you can get early, ad-free access to episodes with images by joining the growing list of Patreon supporters. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose a level of support you're comfortable with. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin territory, also called Ottawa, Canada. This episode, we're really going to focus on the chronological description of the war on the Eastern Front. It's a bit of an experiment, but it's what I was trying to do with the podcast from the beginning, to put the developments of the war on the Eastern Front into the complete context by talking about what's concurrently going on across the different theaters of war. Almost all histories of the Second World War are presented as linked episodes. The invasion of Poland, the Battle of France, the evacuation of Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, the Battle of El Alamein, and so on. And yes, they're in more or less a chronological order. But what often gets missed, or at least I did not often catch, was where events in different places overlapped. So for example, the British Army's advance on El Agheila in North Africa was concurrent with the Red Army's winter offensive, which drove the German Army Group Center back from Moscow in late 1941. Or that while the British and Americans were forcing Rommel to retreat at Medinine in Tunisia, the Germans were also withdrawing from the Demyansk and Rzhev salients in Russia, while Field Marshal Erich von Manstein recaptured Kharkiv in Ukraine. That context is essential to understanding the whole war. It's not sufficient, but it is necessary. So, let's get on with the chronology. To get on with the chronology, we're going to start today in January 1944, so 81 years ago from the date of recording this, and go on to the midpoint of February. I think you'll probably want to open up the webpage for this episode, maybe on a different device, depending on how you're listening to it, to see the map I put up, because we're going to be moving up and down the Eastern Front a lot. You see, Stalin had this idea, or this supposed strategy, he called it the Broad Front. The idea was attack everywhere along this 1,500-mile front, everywhere, all the time. sooner or later, the Germans have to crack somewhere. Of course, this is only possible because of the USSR's vast supply of people, of men to throw into the meat grinder, their great and growing manufacturing capability at this time, and let's not leave out the essential millions of tons of lend-lease aid they're getting from the West. Now, once again, before I go on, a little bit more context. The last episode discussed the first two of 10 crushing blows that Stalin would later boast about in November 1944. The Zhytomyr-Berdychev offensive, which drove the Germans away from the right bank of the Dnipro River in Ukraine, and the end of the siege of Leningrad at the northern end of that contiguous front. What you're going to see over the next several episodes of this podcast is that the momentum now is definitely with the USSR, as Germany is pressed from several sides, in Italy, in Greece, by resistance in the occupied territories, in the air over Germany, and especially on the Eastern Front. But even now, Germany is not down for the count. Not yet. Historian Anthony Tucker Jones points out that in 1944, the German armed forces had never been larger. They had more at this point, January 1944, more than 9 million men under arms. And over half of them were in the Heer, or army, or the Waffen, or armed SS. This broke down to 315 divisions, 248 infantry, 34 panzer, 17 panzer grenadier, which is infantry that accompanies panzers, usually in armored vehicles, and another 6 parachute divisions. Of these 315 divisions, 179, so more than half, were on the Eastern Front. On the Eastern Front in the army, that's 3.1 million men, plus another 800,000 from German collaborationist or vassal states like Hungary, Romania, and elsewhere. Before we get deep into what's happening on the Eastern Front, let's get some more context with our regular feature, what else is happening in the war? 11 January, Count Ciano, the Italian foreign minister, is executed by the pro-Mussolini forces for his role in ousting Il Duce from power. 16 January, General Dwight Eisenhower assumes his post as commanding general, U.S. forces, European theater of operations. 17 January, the First Battle of Monte Cassino begins as the British 10th Corps attacks the western end of Germany's Gustav Line across Italy. 22nd January, the Allies land at Anzio on Italy's Adriatic coast in Operation Shingle. 31st January, American forces land in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific in Operation Flintlock. 2nd February, Germans defeat the Americans in the Battle of Cisterna near Anzio, Italy. 5th February, U.S. Navy bombards the Kuril Islands, the northernmost of Japan's home islands. 15th February, the Second Battle of Monte Cassino begins as Allied bombers destroy the Benedictine Monastery there. 17th February, American Marines land on Inuwatuk in the Marshall Islands. 19th February, the beginning of the Big Week, an Allied bombing campaign of German industrial cities. Okay, so that's the context outside the Eastern Front. Now let's zoom in on the main topic of this podcast. On 5th January 1944, the Red Army launched the Kirovograd Offensive. Following the success of the Zhytomyr-Berdychev Offensive, described last episode, Stavka ordered the 2nd Ukrainian Front, commanded by Ivan Konev, plus elements of the 3rd and 4th Ukrainian Fronts, to attack toward Kirovograd, now known as Kropivnitsky, which is about 100 kilometers due south of Cherkasy. In early January 1944, the 2nd Ukrainian Front included the 4th, 5th, and 7th Guards armies, guards being an honorific for outstanding achievements, bravery, effectiveness, and so on. So the 7th Guards Army, the 37th, 52nd, 53rd, and 57th Armies, the 5th Guards Tank Army, the 5th Guards Cavalry Corps, the 20th Tank Corps, the 1st, 7th, and 8th Mechanized Corps, plus air support of the 5th Air Army. In total, that's 550,000 men, 256 tanks, 127 self-propelled guns, 7,136 assault guns and mortars, 777 anti-aircraft guns, and 500 combat aircraft. That is an immense force, more than 500,000 men. At this point, the German units they were going up against, the 11th and 52nd Corps and the 47th Panzer Corps of the 8th Army, numbered at most 260,000 men, less than half the Red Army brought against them, with 110 operational tanks, 62 assault guns, 71 self-propelled anti-tank guns and artillery pieces, and a smattering of other semi-operational equipment undergoing some kind of repair, being repaired under fire. Anyway, on 5th January 1944, this is while the Zhytomyr Berdychev offensive described last episode is still going on, the 2nd Ukrainian Front sent two shock units to Kropivnitsky, which is then called Kirovograd. These consisted of the 5th Guards Army and the 7th Mechanized Corps, and they were supposed to attack the city from the northwest. Meanwhile, the 7th Guards Army and the 5th Guards Tank Army would attack at the same time from the southwest. They would split the German 8th Army, encircle, and destroy them. Then the 4th Red Armies were to turn southwest toward Novoukrainka and ultimately Pervomaisk on the southern Bug River, driving the Germans out of another huge chunk of Ukraine. That was the plan. While all that is getting going, we have to shift our attention again to the north, to the Leningrad region. On 14 January, the Volkhov Front, which had captured ruined Novgorod last episode, struck west-northwest toward Luga. Their aim? To link up with the Leningrad Front, which was then moving along the Narva Isthmus, that land bridge between Lake Peipus and the Gulf of Finland. And together, these two groups would encircle the German 18th Army. So they're on the move on the 14th of January. Whoop! One day later, we have to go back south to Ukraine again. On 15 January, Ivan Konev, commander of the 2nd Ukrainian Front, held a planning meeting to discuss his orders to destroy the rest of the 8th Army, which was still in Ukraine. The thing is, the remnants of the 8th Army, after all those offensives, were at this point sitting at the junction of the 1st and 2nd Ukrainian Fronts. Any junction between groups like this is a weak point. So Konev and actually Zhukov's plan would be a double encirclement of this German group. The inner encirclement would surround and destroy the 8th Army, and then an outer ring would be set up to repel any rescue or reinforcement attempts. By this point, the 8th Army consisted of 9 infantry divisions plus 1 panzer or tank division and 1 motorized panzer grenadier division. To overwhelm them, the Red Army sent in both the 1st and 2nd Ukrainian fronts, 27 rifle divisions, 4 tank, 1 mechanized, and 1 cavalry corps, armed with 370 tanks and self-propelled guns, and almost 4,000 guns and mortars. So, another immense force against a battered and weakened and much smaller German force. Not that I have an ounce of sympathy for them. Konev's 2nd Ukrainian Front penetrated the German lines from the southeast by the 25th. The 1st Ukrainian Front under Nikolai Vatutin attacked from the northwest and took to the 28th to get to the town of Zvenihorodka. As you can see in map 1 on the webpage, this is west of the city of Cherkasy on the Dnipro River. This operation became known as the Cherkasy Pocket or Battle of Korsun. Inside this pocket were about 60,000 German men, including the SS Viking Division, the SS Valonian Infantry Brigade, Estonian Narva Battalion, and some Russian auxiliaries, volunteers or people pressed into German service. Together, they had 30 Panzer IIIs and IVs, 12 self-propelled guns, and 35 other artillery pieces. The senior commander in this pocket was one General Wilhelm Stemmermann, so together they were called the Stemmermann Gruppe, or Stemmermann Group. According to Antony Beevor, Konev also ordered supporting units of the Red Air Force to bomb wooden buildings in the towns and villages within the pocket with incendiaries. Quote, "This would force the undernourished German troops out into the bitter cold," end quote. It would also force out any surviving Russian and Ukrainian citizens who would now have even less food and shelter. Quotes Beevor, "Konev, who, according to Beria's son, had wicked little eyes, a shaven head that looked like a pumpkin, and an expression full of self-conceit, was utterly ruthless," end quote. I've put a picture of Ivan Konev on the webpage. Decide for yourself about his eyes and pumpkin head. The Red Army completed the ring around the Korsun pocket by 31st January, the same day the Berdichev offensive ended just north of this area. The Germans indeed tried to counterattack to rescue the Stemmermann group. The German 8th Air Corps began flying in supplies on 28 January, but they had to contend with the Red Air Force's fighter planes and anti-aircraft fire. They did manage to bring 83,000 gallons of fuel, 868 tons of ammunition, and 4 tons of medical supplies to the encircled units, and fly more than 4,100 wounded men out. But they lost 50 planes in this operation. Now we see Stalin's broad front strategy at work. Concurrent offenses all along the front. Leningrad, Cherkasy, southern Ukraine, and we'll get to that. Last episode described how the commander of Army Group North, Field Marshal Georg von Kukler, after the liberation of Leningrad, had wanted to withdraw his forces back to the so-called Panther defensive line that ran from Narva south to Lake Peipus. Hitler fired him for that and replaced him with General Walter Model, who quickly convinced Hitler to allow that very same withdrawal. So now that the Red Army had pushed the Germans back from Leningrad, Stavka, the Soviet Supreme Command, wanted to keep going, keep up that momentum. If they could push the Wehrmacht out of Estonia, the Soviet Baltic fleet could get out of the Gulf of Finland and possibly take part in finally destroying Army Group North. Then they could push through Latvia and Lithuania and maybe even into East Prussia, Germany. From a political perspective, conquering Estonia would put more pressure on Finland, which is holding a line just north of Leningrad in Karelia. Stalin ordered the Red Army to capture the city of Narva, Estonia, on that isthmus or strip of land between Lake Peipus and the Gulf of Finland. The city itself lay on the left or western bank of the Narva River, which drains the lake into the Gulf. Stalin gave the Leningrad Front a deadline of 17 February to capture the city. Now, the terrain in this isthmus is really rough. Heavily forested with lots of swamps, streams, and lakes. Kind of like northern Ontario or Minnesota. Three Red Armies went to capture Narva. The 2nd Shock Army, the 59th Army, and the 8th Army, arranged north and south respectively along the Narva River from the Bay of Narva, an inlet of the Gulf of Finland, to Lake Peipus. On 1st February 1944, the 109th Rifle Corps of the 2nd Shock Army captured the town of Kingisepp on the Luga River, on the highway east of Narva, and pushed the German 18th Army back west to Narva. This is clear on Map 2 on the webpage. The Battle of Narva proper began the next day, 2nd February. The Soviet 4th Rifle Regiment of the 2nd Shock Army crossed the Narva River north of the town, and the Germans blew up the ice south of the town all the way to Lake Peipus to try to prevent the Soviets from crossing. That did not prevent the Red Army's 122nd Rifle Corps from crossing the river and setting up a bridgehead in the Krivasu Swamp. And you can see that in Map 3 on the webpage. All the lettering on there is in Cyrillic script, So for those of you who don't read Cyrillic, what looks like Hapba toward the upper right side of the map, that's Cyrillic for Narva. And then below that, to the more or less the center of the whole map, you can see where the Red Army is penetrating or crossing over the Narva River and setting up that bridgehead. As you can see on those two maps, maps 2 and 3, all this action left the Red Army with a bridgehead on the west side of the river, north of Narva, and the Germans holding a bridgehead on the east side of the river at the town itself. This spot was held by the 3rd Panzer Corps, which mostly consisted of SS volunteer formations, that is, ethnic Germans from Romania, Nazi sympathizers from Western Europe, and a Dutch SS brigade. Elsewhere along this front, Estonian units resisted the advance of the Red Army. They'd had enough of Russian occupation since 1940. The Red 43rd and 109th Rifle Corps attacked this bridgehead on 2nd February, but suffered heavy casualties and failed to destroy it. Meanwhile, 10 kilometers or 6 miles south of the town, the 1078th Regiment and the Ski Battalion of the 314th Rifle Division advanced under heavy bombardment. After two regiments reinforced them, they had managed to advance to the rail line. You can see that's the alternating black and white line going right across the map. And that's where the front line stalled for several months. 40 kilometers or 25 miles farther south, two platoons tried to cross the Narva River and ran into an Estonian police battalion, which halted their advance. And while that's happening on 2nd February in the north, Stalin's broad front strategy is in action farther south in Ukraine. But before we get to it, let's take a breath. In part two, we'll move south. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian man, Maurice Bury, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941, just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. It comes in three volumes, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War. The Eastern Front Trilogy is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941, through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine, and finally to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find three individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase a three-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburyauthor.com. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back to part two. Now we're moving again from the north to the south, the southern sector of the Eastern Front. 2nd February 1944. The 1st Ukrainian Front has captured the cities of Rivne, or Rovno, and Lutsk in northwestern Ukraine. Rivne, then called Rovno in Russian, had been the capital of Reichskommissariat Ukraine, or I guess more accurately, the place where the Reichskommissar of Ukraine, Eric Koch, had set up his headquarters. Now, this conquest by the Red Army marked the first time the Red Army had crossed the border that the Nazis and communists had established between their spheres of control between them during their false alliance between 1939 and 1941. And for a complete understanding of that alliance, go back to episodes 64 and 65, where author and historian Roger Moorhouse describes the Hitler-Stalin pact. But we are back in Ukraine on 2nd February 1944, so let's check in on the Cherkasy pocket. Ivan Konev, the commander of the 2nd Ukrainian Front, ordered the 4th Guards Army and the 5th Guards Cavalry Corps to split the German forces trapped in the pocket. The 5th SS Division's armor, plus the 72nd Infantry Division, resisted them, or tried to. Meanwhile, Erich von Manstein, commander of Army Group South, sent the 3rd and 47th Panzer Corps to relieve Gruppe Stemmermann, as they were calling the forces in the pocket. Manstein wanted to force an escape corridor, but Hitler ordered them to encircle the encirclement. He didn't want anybody to surrender. He didn't want to give up any ground. The 3rd Panzer Corps was equipped with Tiger and Panther tanks, the latest models the Wehrmacht had available. They also had engineer units to build bridges. But the other unit, the 11th Panzer Division of the 47th Panzer Corps, had only 27 tanks and 34 assault guns. So, the attempt to encircle the Red Army's double encirclement of the Stemmermann Group stalled by 8th February. They just didn't have the numbers or the resources necessary to carry out that order. But before we go any further, we have to go back up north again and back one day to 7th February. The 2nd Shock Army expanded its bridgehead south of Narva, temporarily cutting the Narva-Tallinn Railway behind the 3rd SS Panzer Corps. Army Group North called in reinforcements, which were Estonian units. Again, these are Estonians who recently agreed to support the Germans because they were even more opposed to the Russians. Meanwhile, the Red Army's 108th Rifle Corps crossed Lake Peipus at its southern end and established a bridgehead at Mirapalu. That's where the lake gets quite narrow. Now we have to get back down to the south. I warned you! On 8th February, the 4th Ukrainian Front captured the city of Nikopol on the Dnipro River, where it flowed westward before its final bend toward the Black Sea. The German attempt to surround the double encirclement at Korsun had failed, so the relief units shifted to Manstein's original sensible idea. On 11 February, the 3rd Panzer Corps tried to penetrate the Red Army's double encirclement to break the Stemmermann Group out. They established a bridgehead across the Gniloy-Tokach River. On map 1, you can see that at the bottom center. All the Stemmermann Group had to do at this point was break through the double encirclement and meet up with the 3rd Panzer Corps at Lysychansk. Yeah, that's all. Just break through those heavy Soviet lines with their T-34s and KV-1s. Simple, right? At this point, with the Stemmermann Group still trapped in that shrinking pocket, Marshal Zhukov sent emissaries to the pocket to discuss terms of surrender. The talks went nowhere, even though two groups of German POWs, you know, men who had been captured before this, and they had formed anti-Hitler organizations. They were the National Committee for a Free Germany and the League of German Officers. And representatives of these groups visited the front on 10th February to try to convince their compatriots in the pocket to surrender. They even brought leaflets to encourage this, and some 18,000 Germans took the offer. But not all. On 12 February, Stalin unified authority to destroy the pocket under Konev, who was really Zhukov's rival, and this is going to be an important factor soon. So on the 11th and 12th of February, the Germans in the pocket began moving toward that breakout area. By the 15th, they had gotten within 7 kilometers of that bridge at Lysychansk. By this point, the Cherkasy pocket was only 5 kilometers or 3 miles in diameter, and everybody in there was packed in tight. There was no room to maneuver. Even so, over the next several days, the Red Air Force repeatedly bombed and strafed the pocket while Soviet armor bombarded them. Cossack cavalry raided into the pocket, reportedly hacking off the raised hands of men who tried to surrender. On 15 February, the Red 30th Guards Rifle Corps and the 124th Rifle Corps launched a new offensive in Narva, but were halted and exhausted by an Estonian group. Both sides brought in reinforcements and paused for another 2 weeks. That same day, 15 February, the Volkhov Front, along with the 42nd and 67th Armies of the Leningrad Front, reached Lake Peipus, having pushed the army group north, especially the 18th Army, 50 to 120 kilometers further west. That night, the night of the 15th to the 16th of February, the SS Volunteer Grenadier Regiment of the 1st Estonian Division, plus a battalion of the 44th Infantry Regiment from East Prussia, destroyed the Soviet bridgehead at the south end of Lake Peipus. But now we have to, after that brief intermission, we have to get back to the Cherkasy pocket. So, on 16th February, Manstein radioed Stemmerman, password freedom objective Lysychansk, 2300 hours, end quote. So that meant that the Stemmerman group was supposed to start moving toward the bridgehead that Manstein had established at Lysychansk at 11 p.m. Leaving behind 1,450 non-ambulatory wounded with doctors and orderlies, the Stemmerman group started moving south under darkness. They had to veer around a hill that was held by a whole bunch of T-34 tanks. But as they went past there, they found that their vehicles, their tanks, their panzers, and so on, could not manage the hills because they were covered with slippery, melting snow. So the Germans had to leave their armor and their vehicles behind. They destroyed them so that they wouldn't fall into Soviet hands and proceed, mostly on foot. As the morning of 17 February broke, Konev sent in a brigade of KV-2 heavy tanks, the ones that were called the Joseph Stalin tanks. These were huge monsters. And they went in and broke up the German units into isolated groups to try to destroy them. Quote, under the yellow sky of early morning and over ground covered with wet snow, Soviet tanks made straight for the thick of the column, plowing up and down, killing and crushing with their tracks. Almost simultaneously, masked Cossack cavalry wheeled away from the tanks to hunt down and massacre men fleeing for the refuge of the hills. Hands held high in surrender, the Cossacks sliced off with their sabers. The killing in this human hunt went on for several hours, and a new round opened on the banks of the river Gnoj-Tikhich, where the survivors of the first collision of the German column with Soviet troops dragged and fought their way. End quote. Disorganized, the Germans fled to the Gnoj-Tikhich River, swollen with spring melt, but they were downstream of the rescuers' bridgehead, the 3rd Panzer Corps. They drove their few remaining vehicles into the river and attempted to make bridges from trees and logs and whatever else they could find. Hundreds were swept away by the current and drowned. Even if they made it across, many more died of hypothermia. By the end of the day, though, the Panzer Corps engineers were able to build more bridges, allowing most of the men, trucks, and horses of Gruppe Stemmeren to escape. But they had to leave behind all their heavy equipment. And the commander, General Wilhelm Stemmeren himself, was killed. So there we have it. The Red Army has pushed the invaders back from Leningrad all the way to the Narva River by late February 1944. North of Leningrad, the lines remained pretty much static, even though the Red Air Force launched 6,000 bombing sorties in February. In Ukraine, Vatutin's first Ukrainian front had pushed the Wehrmacht almost into modern-day Poland. That just left the southwestern quarter of the country occupied by Nazi Germany. Ivan Konev got full credit for the victory at Korsun, or the Cherkasy Pocket. Unfairly, according to several historians, General Nikolai Vatutin, commander of the 1st Ukrainian Front, had a lot to do with that success as well, but he was kind of frozen out. He wasn't liked as much by Stalin at this point. Konev got promoted to Marshal of the Soviet Union, but Vatutin did not. And this is something that Georgi Zhukov, Stalin's right-hand man, would criticize many years later. Elimination of the Cherkasy Pocket resulted in 40,000 Germans killed, captured, and wounded, and the destruction of 300 tanks and assault guns, as well as 50 aircraft in that airlift attempt. Soviet casualties were double that, 25,000 killed or missing and 56,000 wounded and sick, as well as the loss of 728 tanks. Those numbers are staggering. 25,000 men dead. That's a good-sized town. In the north, the fighting from Leningrad and Novgorod to the Narva River and the shores of Lake Peipus cost the Red Army 77,000 dead and missing, and over 237,000 wounded. The Germans lost 25,000 dead and missing, and almost 47,000 wounded. I really cannot wrap my head around these numbers. These battles set the stage for a major push through the spring. 1944, even at this early point, is starting to look like a mirror image of 1941. But as we'll see, progress for the Red Army, while rapid, is not nearly as fast as the Wehrmacht's blitzkrieg 3 years earlier. Stavka's next orders for the 1st and 2nd Ukrainian fronts were to turn southward. But we'll have to get to that next episode. I've been talking at you for close to 40 minutes now. Please come back in 2 weeks for more chronological developments in Ukraine, the Baltic states, and yes, Russia in the center of it all. It's going to be another roller coaster up and down the front lines. Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. You'll find maps for this episode on the webpage. Just go to beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com and click on the title for the episode. Clicking on the picture for the episode will start a player in your browser. If that's how you want to listen, that's great. Go ahead. Now, I want to ask, what do you think of this strict chronological exposition where I am following the timeline strictly, but because of that, moving up and down the Eastern Front? Do you find that approach helps you understand what's going on at the same time in different places? Or do you feel whiplash from all this zooming up and down? Let me know. You can reach me by email at contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca. You can also reach me through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. I know you can find it. You can also find me on Blue Sky at scottthewriter.bsky.social. Let me know if you have any questions, comments, clarifications, or, I hope not, but any corrections. And if you have a moment, please hit that follow button on your podcast app. If you can, please leave me a podcast rating. Whatever you feel, I want to know what you really think. If you have a little more time, please consider a review. Just a couple of lines will make a big difference in helping other people find the show. I want to thank all of you who are following, and especially all of you who support the podcast on Patreon. If you want episodes early and ad-free, and with pictures and maps embedded in the podcast, go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose the level of support you're comfortable with. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Bird. I'm Scott Bird. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina!